There are a lot of myths about Mozart, that he was tormented, that he struggled all his life to make a mark in the world. But the writer and composer Jan Swofford says Mozart was actually jolly, jolly and informal. He was fundamentally a happy man, liked to be around friends, he partied, he could be raunchy. But his musical genius, that was no myth. That was legit. And Swofford says in a new biography that this was clear from the beginning of Mozart's life. In the book, Swofford tells the story of one evening in the Mozart household. This was January 1761. Mozart is four years old.
You may be a believer in miracles if you're a religious man, but you don't expect them to happen in the living room. Leopold was giving a lesson to Wolfgang's sister, Nannerl, who was turning out to be a prodigy as a keyboard player. And suddenly the little boy, the four-year-old, said, "I want to play the keyboard." And Leopold was a teacher and a very smart man. He said, "Sure, why not?" And the boy sat down and proceeded to, in a half hour, learned to play this piece that his sister had been playing that day. And the piece was not the easiest piece in her book at all. He not only learned to play it with impeccable rhythm, he memorized it. Now, anybody who knows anything about music knows that this sort of thing is just not possible, really. But it happened anyway. He played the piano at age four as if he'd been playing it for a long time. His father, of course, was just thunderstruck. And being a religious man, he came to feel that this was a miracle of God. And it went on from there. The child just started soaking up music like a sponge, learning piece after piece. And, you know, there are people with remarkable capacities who reveal them quite early, but this, all the same, was something on a level that was really quite freakish.
Fast forward to about a year later, December 11th, he's 5 years old now, he starts to do more than just play. Talk about this moment.
He starts to compose. It's a real little piece with a shape. It's very pretty. Nothing world-shaking, but for a five-year-old, this is something fairly remarkable. It is unmistakably a minuet, both in musical and in dance form. And it's absolutely a danceable minuet. So already Wolfgang understands instinctively what a genre is. It was not that much later that he was writing longer pieces, flute sonatas and piano sonatas. And by the time he was 7 or 8 years old, he was writing symphonies for full orchestra. What does gifted mean? That you instinctively solve problems that other people have to study to solve. And what that means in practice is that Wolfgang was a tremendous mimic. And music, to a great degree, involves mimicry when you first start. That's why the ability to do that, to pick up things by ear, is very important. That is one of his secrets, that he was able to mimic how a piece went, to understand it and reproduce it and add something of his own to make it new. His music was not distinctive for a long time to come, but it was expertly done mimicry.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Jan Swofford is with us talking about his new biography. It's called Mozart, The Reign of Love. And one of the things Swofford brings to his biographies of musicians like Brahms and Beethoven and Ives is that he himself is a composer. So one of the things he does with the writing is include what he describes as a literature of music. We spoke with Jan Swofford in May.
If you're a listener, you tend to view music one way, in a very personal and private way. If you've studied music, if you're a performer, you look at music a different way. You look at the page as a kind of Talmudic object that it's your job to understand and to realize. If you're a composer, you look at it as something that somebody wrote down one note at a time, and you understand what it means to conceive a piece from sort of nothing or from little wisps of things, and to gradually turn it into something solid. But I understand how a composer thinks that a piece can be originated in any kind of thing. One of Beethoven's inspirations was a horse galloping by the window. Another was the starry sky. With Mozart, he didn't talk about his inspirations much, but dance was clearly a big inspiration for him. And I sort of understand how these things work. I understand how influences and mimicry work. And I understand that Mozart was somebody very much involved in convention. And the conventions of music, this is how harmony goes. This is what a good melody amounts to. These are all things that were very rationalized. This was the age of reason, the Enlightenment. All these things and the musical forms of the time were very rationalized. This is how a sonata goes. This is how a minuet goes. And Mozart didn't rebel against any of those things. So I know as a composer that you internalize genres and conventions, and then you actualize them in your own terms. And you may have a voice. I also understand that a voice, an individual voice, is something that either happens or it doesn't. It can't be taught. It can't be learned. It's sort of like your voice is like the back of your hand. In a very profound way, it's who you are. And in comparison to somebody like, say, Mahler, who hit on his voice very early, and it was a unique voice, it was absolutely unmistakable, Mozart was somebody who started off working within convention and became a very professional, very slick, in a way, composer at an early age, and finally ended up, by his teens, later teens, having gone through convention and begun to find his own voice, not opposed to convention, but within it. That's his particular thing, which is different than Beethoven and it's different than Bach.
One of the things you write about is that Mozart posed a particular problem in the writing. And you say that you've never found another composer who, as you put it, beggars language as Mozart does, in the sense that you're trying to capture music in prose as a writer, and the language that Mozart created with his music, you said, posed a particular problem. What are you getting at there?
Mozart is so involved with what music can do that is different than what language can do. And part of it is the fact that he mostly submits to convention. So he doesn't play with form, for example, with formal models as much as Beethoven did, or as much as Haydn did, often for that matter. So you can't say, here's something very unusual he did in putting these themes together. In his later music, some of that you can talk about. Also in Mozart's time, the idea of music as an implied narrative, which is very strong in Beethoven, that whole idea didn't really exist yet. In Beethoven, you can talk about, for example, the famous Fifth Symphony, From Darkness to Light, from the kind of fatalistic driving first movement to the triumphant finale. That's a kind of implied story that helps hold a piece together, and Beethoven always has that kind of unity in the expressive and narrative quality of his music. Mozart, by and large, you can see the things that hold the pieces together in technical terms, you know, motivic connections and things like that. But you can't, he didn't have so much of this sense of piece as a narrative, so you can't really talk about that. And some of those Sturm und Drange pieces, like the G minor symphony and the both the early and the later G minor symphony, and a few pieces like that as minor key, really intense pieces, you really do see a kind of coloration over the whole piece. But in some of his pieces, really one of the main issues is beauty, just sheer beauty. And I finally realized that in dealing with Mozart's music, a lot of it has to do with the question of beauty, and it's very hard to talk about beauty, too. I read a whole lot of material about beauty, and I didn't feel all that terribly enlightened by it. And we're not taught about beauty in college. You don't get beauty has been out of fashion for a long time, including in among artists. Mm. It's often considered to be a sort of mushy, sentimental, subjective quality that is too subjective for academics and too mushy and sentimental and bourgeois for artists. So beauty is often dismissed or ignored. I gather there's some sort of a movement to reclaim beauty as a serious subject of inquiry these days. But I think to deal with Mozart is to deal with the issue of beauty, and sometimes I felt that I needed to be more of a poet than I am to truly talk about it. I think I only touched on it here and there.
This was interesting. You write that a certain point in the writing process that your words were coming out looser and more informal than in previous biographies. What was happening there?
Well, I realized that it was influenced by the style of Mozart's letters, which are so wonderful.
Yeah.
A lot of them. Some of them are, as I say, are so obscene they could clean your sinuses. But he doesn't have to be obscene to be funny. And his letters are always imaginative and fascinating. One of the first things I do when I'm writing a biography, I type up a basic chronology, and then I type up hundreds of pages of letters. And by the time you've typed up hundreds of pages of somebody's own words, you have a sense of how they talk and how they think. And there's no other way to do that, to get that. One of the first things I realized was that Mozart had a tone with every person he wrote to that was extremely consistent. All of us do that to a degree. We don't write our friends the way we write mom and dad. That's true. But Mozart was extraordinarily strong about that. Every friend he had a particular tone, and that tone was absolutely consistent, sometimes over a period of years. But I realized that, in a way, Mozart was a man of the theater, and he was a theatrical person. I came to the conclusion that Mozart had the personality of an actor.
Yeah. Did Mozart think he was writing music for the ages, for some kind of legacy?
I don't think so, because that whole idea wasn't around yet.
Yeah.
It really wasn't. And I think that's very important. And that's something else that I think I understand as a composer. The first composer whose music basically stayed in the repertoire at full strength was Handel. And again, Handel died when Haydn was in his 20s and Mozart was 3. So the idea that your music could be part of a permanent repertoire was brand new in Mozart's lifetime. And I never saw any example of either him or Haydn talking in those terms about what's going to happen to my music after I'm dead.
Well, you also mentioned that Mozart did not have a sense that an artist was in the job of expressing himself.
No, that's a romantic idea from the 19th century. Mozart would probably have said, I'm in the business of expressing music, universal music and universal human feeling. And that's what this is about. Of course, I have my own voice, and originality was valued. But originality was part of a spectrum of what you were expected to, of what was admired about you as a composer. And taste was another, and taste had very much to do with things of the moment. I found critics saying that Mozart's music is going to be immortal, but I never found him talking in those terms. Uh-huh. Now, Beethoven did. Beethoven was very aware that he was writing music that was going to be around in the future, and he said so, and he used the word immortal. And that changes you as an artist. When you feel that your name and your work are going to be part of something permanent in humanity, in the history of human creativity and culture, it changes you as an artist. I'm not saying it makes you better. It's not a matter of better or worse. It's just different. Mozart didn't have that idea. He just didn't think that way.
Jan Swofford, his new biography is Mozart, The Reign of Love. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
As part of our public service mission, KUER provides programming that informs, engages, and inspires Utahns. That's why we offer a stream of classical music called Classical KUER. Simply put, you'll hear music that spans centuries, modern composers, and hosts eager to curate a seamless listening experience. You can learn more and listen to our classical music service on the KUER mobile app and at classicalkuer.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the biographer and composer Jan Swofford is with us talking about his new book, Mozart, The Reign of Love. Mozart was an amazing prodigy. He memorized and played full pieces when he was four, composed his first work at five. Now, he died young, but Swofford says in the book that really was the only profound tragedy in his life, which, of course, doesn't live up to the image of a tormented artist. But Mozart was a happy and funny person who had a boundless appetite for life. And Swofford says he doesn't think that should take away from his brilliance as an artist. Back to the conversation. You begin with Mozart's father, Leopold, in the book. So I wanted to talk about how important he was to, of course, telling this story. Because you say in the book that one of Leopold Mozart, his father, one of his limitations was his, and this is how you put it, his incapacity to understand what his son became and his incapacity to understand what he had become to his son. Explain that dynamic, if you would.
What Leopold told his son is that music is a job. You have to impress the people with the most money, who would be the aristocracy. And the goal of your career is to get a good job in a court or at a church and make a lot of money and support your family. So part of Leopold's problem with what his son became is that his son never had a job as a Kapellmeister at a court or a cathedral. Though when Mozart died, he was about to get the job as the Kapellmeister of St. Stephen's Cathedral, which was the best job in town. Whether he would have been able to put up with that job and do it well is a real question. He never had to do that. I'm not sure he would have been up to it. Mozart always claimed that he wanted a Kapellmeister job, but I'm not sure he would have been, that would have suited him. So Leopold was never happy that his son never got a good job, is what it amounts to.
Was Leopold the ultimate stage father? There is that impression that he was taking his son around, and his daughter too, of course, in these long tours of Europe, as when Mozart was young, that he was a performing monkey or something like that. I mean, what were those impressions? Were those ideas actually real?
Yes, Leopold was the ultimate stage father. With his son, at least, the impetus came from the beginning from Wolfgang. With his sister, Nannerl, Leopold would have said, "You're going to play piano," and he discovered that she was very good, but it was his idea. And the fact is, Nannerl always did what Papa said, and she always stayed with Papa and allied with him ultimately against Wolfgang. Whereas Wolfgang had the bit in his teeth from the beginning And yes, he did what Papa said. We're going to go on this tour. We're going to play courts. You will play. You will do your tricks. You'll play with the. You'll name pitches across the room. You'll improvise song on. You'll accompany songs you never heard before, and you'll do the routine. But the reality is that Mozart, as a kid, loved that stuff. There's no indication that he ever had nerves or resistance to doing all this stuff because he loved it and he considered it fun and easy. He once said in a letter to home, he wrote, "I compose as easily as a sow piddles." And that's sort of the way it was. And he reached his maturity when he didn't have, when he didn't give in actually to that kind of facility anymore.
Well, that, I think that gets us, Jan, to an important point, something that you say at various times throughout the book, that it's just not accurate to say Wolfgang Mozart was a suffering genius. I mean, he may have been a genius, but he didn't live a particularly tragic life. He had a good childhood. He was a fundamentally happy man. And I'm wondering how we got to the point where we think of him as this suffering genius, because he wasn't.
It's because it makes a better story. That's why. Yeah. Several things about that, and it's a very good point. First of all, to say Mozart was a happy man and he was not a tragic figure. He's a tragic figure in one sense, is that he died young. And right. To me, that's the... some people, I mean, one reviewer saying, how can this writer say that Mozart was a happy man when he had a row of children die? Well, everybody had a row of children die in those days. Mm-hmm. I can't remember how many children his mother had. Was it seven and two of them survived? Half of one's children in those days survived at best. Yeah. That's the way it was. Yes, he had money troubles later in life, but a lot of very successful people have money troubles, and it partly had to do with things out of his control. He was fundamentally a happy man who was doing what he wanted to do, ultimately the way he wanted to do it. He was enormously respected. He was not the most popular composer around, but a lot of his rivals wrote 10 times more operas than he did. And had been around for a lot longer. He was not particularly upset that other people were more popular than he was. Somebody said to him once, you know, the emperor said, "Don Giovanni is too strong for the teeth of my Viennese." He just shrugged and said, "Let him chew on it for a while." He didn't complain. He was down on people he thought were overrated and things like that. He could be very catty. But he didn't worry over much about what people thought of what he did, because he knew how good he was. And the fact is, the greatest living other composer, Haydn, said that this guy is far better than I am. Yeah. He had that kind of respect from fellow musicians. And he had his big hits. He was not like he was. People said he wrote too many notes. He was too difficult. His orchestra covered up the singers, yada, yada. These were very common things to say about it. But they always prefaced it by saying, well, of course, he's a great genius. He's extraordinary. Yeah. But there's a wonderful review of Don Giovanni, which said this movement, this opera insults religion. It is amoral. It is absolutely objectionable in every way, except, of course, for the music. This is Mozart. Nobody ever wrote better music than this. So even some of his bad reviews said this is the greatest composer who ever lived.
I do think it's interesting that there is this, you know, myth of the fact that he was a tragic figure. And I wonder if it, in some ways it's because people are trying to reconcile the brilliance of his work with something flawed in his character or circumstance. Like, you can't have brilliance without something more dramatic happening.
That's the way we want to look at our artists, as weirdos and suffering figures. Well, some were, and the answer is some aren't, sure. And revolutionaries. The romantic myth is that artists are suffering geniuses who are demigods, for Mozart, genius and his generation, genius was something you possessed. For the Romantics, genius was something you innately were that possessed you and made you into a kind of demigod, and suffering was part of the the equation. And eventually, more and more in the sense, by the time modernism came around, revolution and innovation became part of the equation. It was the coin of the realm. Mozart didn't conform to any of that.
I want to come back to something you mentioned about his letters being sometimes they could clear your sinuses. They were so obscene. Let's talk about one in particular, letter, maybe a series of letters. This is one that you reference to a cousin, dearest Cuzbuzz, as he begins the letter. Talk about this particular moment in this letter, because you describe it as something that he wrote in one of the most manic letters of his life, you say.
Yeah. He was fooling around with a cousin of his. Most of the rabidly obscene letters of his life were written to her. And this was in a very particular period of his life, around age 20. He could get raunchy later on, but never as much as he did with her. And one thing to keep in mind is this was a Salzburg style of humor. His mother was the same way. You see it even sometimes from his father. So even in that, Mozart was in a way coming out of convention, even in your obscenity. He just carried it further than most people, and he was more imaginative. But part one of these letters to his cousin is a favorite of mine because it's not obscene. It is proto-surrealistic, and it is just wild. Can I read a little of it?
Of course.
I will say that there are some sexual double entendres in here that are all the way through it, and that's also part of his letters to her. So this is the letter. Now, where was I? Oh, this is part of a long letter he wrote to her. Where was I? Oh, yes, will come. Yes, yes, they will come. Well, who will come? Oh, yes, now I remember. Letters will come. But what kind of letters? Well, now, letters from me, of course. I want to make sure that you send these to me. Now, numero two, I'm asking you, why not? I'm asking you, dearest numbskull, why not? If you're writing anyway to Madame Tavernier in Munich, please include regards from me. Why not? Strange. Why not? And to the younger, I mean Fräulein Josepha, tell her also my sincere apologies. Why not? Why should I not apologize? Strange. I don't know why not. I want to apologize that I haven't yet sent her the sonata, I promised, but I will send it as soon as possible. Why not? What? Why not? Why shouldn't I send it? Strange. I wouldn't know why not. Well, you'll do me this favor. Why not? It's so strange. After all, I'll do it to you, too, if you want me to. Why not? Why shouldn't I do it to you? Strange. Why not?
Wow. You say that's musical. You talk about it being partly musical in its effect.
It reminds me of an aria, where you repeat words like that over and over. I think it is almost a parody of an aria.
I want to ask you about his process. Because you write about him sitting up into the night, moving between the keyboard and his writing table. And there's this moment in a section where he's writing for this competition, this operas. And I think he's 16 years old at the time. And you say his fingers were aching as he wrote tens of thousands of notes. And as you put it, every one of them was this choice, and it was a decision that would finally lead up to an opera. Talk a little bit about this moment. There's a letter associated with this and of course, a piece of music, Exultate Jubilate. You want to talk about that?
Well, he was, by age 16, Mozart was he wrote his first opera when he was 12. He was an experienced professional opera composer writing on venues, on major venues, in this case, in Italy. So he's writing a big opera, opera seria, a serious opera for Milan, and the other people writing operas for the same festival are some of the most famous composers of the time. He's learning how to juggle not only drama and music applied to drama, and timing on the stage and movement on the stage and all these issues and how you handle an orchestra behind singers, all these things, which he was already very experienced at. He was learning how to manage singers and learning how to manage the politics of opera. And he knew, of course, who were really good. And one of the people, when he found out somebody who was really good, he tended to write music for them. And one, this was a period when some of the major opera singers, stars were castratos. So Mozart for this opera was working with a castrato named Venanziano Rauzzini, who was really good apparently, and Mozart wrote a piece for him, which was called Exultate Jubilate.
What do you hear in the music?
Well, in a way, I hear the epitome of what the word Alleluia means as something celebratory. Some of the most vivacious, happy-making music imaginable. What else is there to say?
I wanted to ask you about a moment. This is in July of 1778, and Mozart's mother becomes very ill. She's going to die. She has typhus, you say, you think. And you write about the death watch of his mother, which you say Mozart could only watch helplessly. He couldn't go out. He couldn't work. Talk about this moment and about the piece of music that he writes, the piano sonata that he eventually writes from this moment.
Medicine was medieval in those days. It could do nothing. They mainly drew blood. And she died before his eyes. And what he did was to write a family friend and say, "Mother has died. I want you to go to father and prepare him, because I don't want to tell him flat out. I think it would be too much. It would be too overwhelming." And I think this was a very smart and thoughtful thing to do. So what he writes, Leopold, is, "I hope you are now ready to receive this saddest and most painful news with fortitude. On the third," and notice how precise he is, "on the third at 21 minutes after 10 o'clock at night, my mother passed peacefully to the Lord. When I wrote you, she was already partaking of the heavenly joys. I hope that you and my dear sister will forgive me for this small but necessary deception. Now his divine and most holy will is fulfilled." Now, what he's doing here is trying to console his father with religious boilerplate, is what it amounts to, because he knows that that's how he needs to talk to his father, who is a very religious man. Now, that shows Mozart's care for his father. And Mozart wrote the A minor piano sonata right in this period after his mother died, and it's one of his only two keyboard sonatas in minor. And minor was a very special thing in Mozart's time in the classical period. It was special, and it was often connected to very heavy-duty emotions.
It's interesting you mention how the opening movement isn't necessarily furioso. It's not necessarily tragic. You describe it as, I think you say, rage under restraint.
Yeah, and great nervous energy. And this is a very particular piece with him. It has this driving ferocity that is unusual for him. It's just one of those special pieces.
You mentioned the surges of sound, an image, you say, of surging emotions almost.
Yeah, I think so. I think this is what you hear in this piece. And Mozart's emotions are often hard to pin down. They often seem to be hovering among emotions and turning on a dime from one to another. This piece is absolutely fierce from the beginning, and it stays on that plane with contrasts within that. Mozart in this time is beginning to reach his full maturity as a composer and his full maturity as a person. What I'm saying is that the letters to his father about his mother's death were a sign of his personal maturity, and part of that was his growing independence from his father. And going back home to Salzburg after this experience and getting dumped by the woman he loved was also going to become a necessary part of his maturity, understanding that love doesn't always work out either.
Jan Swofford. His newest biography is Mozart, The Reign of Love. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER is proud to be a listener-supported public radio station. We'd like to thank our community of more than 10,000 sustainers who make a monthly contribution to the station, starting at just $5 a month. Because of your support, all the news, stories, and conversations that you hear are independent, calm, and commercial-free. If something you heard on KUER made a difference to you recently, become a new sustainer or increase your existing pledge at KUER.org/donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation about the legacy of Mozart with the composer and biographer Jan Swofford. We're talking about his new book, Mozart, The Reign of Love. We spoke with him back in May.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the slow movement of the 21st Piano Concerto, the C major. I was talking about this notion of beauty. And one of the great examples of that, I think, is a piece that became a kind of cultural cliche when it was used for a romantic movie in the 60s called A Vera Madigan. And it's this movement has been associated with that kind of tragic romantic movie ever since. But I think it's one of the most beautiful, touching things ever written. And it shows so much about Mozart, but it shows, first of all, this idea of the centrality of beauty in his aesthetic. And also emotions that are subtle and complex. You can't pin this thing down to one feeling or another because it seems to be on an edge between poignancy and languid and poignant and touching, sometimes piercing. It's often quite dissonant, this movement. There's also this perfection that he had of a kind that nobody else has. This continuity of music that seems to reel off with a kind of effortless perfection. To me, this is a piece about the physicality of love, but it's also about mingling of emotions in a kind of narrative way that is impossible to describe in words. It's pure music.
I want to ask you about the Requiem that he writes. Doesn't finish at the end of his life, of course. And he chooses, as you say, the most common key for sorrow and tragedy, D minor. Tell us about the Requiem.
He may or may not have known that this was commissioned by an aristocrat and who was musical in memory of his wife, a requiem for his wife, but also he was in the habit of playing a little game where he passed off other people's music as his own. He would recopy it or have it copied and pretend that he wrote it himself. It was more complicated than that, but that's it in a nutshell. So it was written in a kind, it was commissioned in a kind of secretive way. It may have come through a friend of Mozart who knew this guy. Mozart may have known what was going on, or he may not. He probably didn't care because it was a good commission. He was about to get a job as Kapellmeister of the cathedral. It's the kind of thing he expected to be writing. And he was really gearing, he had never written a requiem before, so he was gearing up to be writing a lot of religious music for his new job and thinking about what kind of religious music he wanted to write. And it's clear he had written a lot of stuff in religious music before, most of it in Salzburg when he was young, and it was a bit old-fashioned, and he knew that. And it's clear that he wanted to write a new kind of religious music that is more immediate and direct than any kind of religious music that had been heard before. It's very simple music. It has a restricted orchestra, and yet it's absolutely powerful. It's a new kind of religious music that is right to the heart of the listener in church. It is absolute church music. And so we see this in the beginning where he's evoking tragedy. It has been said, and I think it's true, that the first movement of the Requiem is some of the most purely and deeply tragic music. Mozart wants to go directly to your feelings and bypass operatic style church music, which was the style. Right to the heart. And the whole Requiem, which sort of gradually faded away in the manuscript as he got sicker, and you see that over and over again in moments of extraordinary beauty and moments of great ferocity. Nobody knew better than Mozart how to express words and feelings.
There came this moment, you write, when he realized he takes to bed. And you say there was a moment when he realized he's sick, of course, again, frequently ill throughout his life. And there comes this moment when he realizes that he's never going to direct this Requiem. It's a moment as if he knows he's going to die in some way.
There had to come a point where he said, I'm not going to get up. This is it. I don't know when that point was. But I do know that at a certain point he got his student, Zusmeier, and started saying to him, look, if I don't finish this, you're gonna have to finish it. And talking to him about what he was doing and showing him sketches. And Zusmeier did finish it, finally. So Mozart clearly at some point understood, nope, I'm not going to get up this time. I've gotten up over and over. It's not going to happen. And the testimony the day before he died is clearly he said to his sister-in-law, you have to stay here and watch me die. And clearly Mozart was not afraid of death. That's what he wrote his father when he realized his father was dying. And this is Masonic doctrine. Mm-hmm. One of the big things about Masonic doctrine, he was a fervent Mason, was getting over the fear of death and hell. So he was not afraid. He knew perfectly well that most people didn't make it out of their 30s in those days. And he was very sad because, as he said to his wife, I'm just about to be prosperous.
I'm leaving just when I could really make the kind of living and get the prosperity. Two people had just offered two aristocrats to give him a yearly stipend for the rest of his life. He was about to get the best job in town, the best paying job. And he was devastated that he was going just, and he was taking a turn in his art with the Requiem and Ave Verum and Magic Flute. That was a really new direction for him, and could have gone who knows where. He was thinking about an opera on Shakespeare's Tempest, which always just wipes me out.
Well, say more about that he was thinking about the Tempest. You say it, this is how you write it in the book. You say, just thinking about that idea makes you weep to think about it.
Well, it does, because he had just written Magic Flute, which was in the direction of something like the Tempest, a magic opera. And the Tempest is so well suited to him, and he knew Shakespeare very well. I think Shakespeare plays a certain part in the background of Magic Flute, which to me, Magic Flute is the most purely Mozartian opera because, A, he was involved with it from the beginning. I mean, Schikaneder, his friend, and who was one of the great theatrical figures of the time and a very experienced actor as well as playwright and composer as well, they kind of planned this thing together. So Mozart had a hand in the libretto from the beginning, even if he didn't write the words. It was also not a court opera. It was independent of court. So he could put aside that whole, all the conventions of court opera and expectations and just write something that was, it was still a familiar, magic opera was a genre. It was familiar. He was still working with a familiar genre, but he was had such freedom in doing this. And that freedom would have just continued if he wrote something on the Tempest. And it would have been a confirmation of this new direction in his art, which he was cut off in the middle of. So Mozart, just imagine somebody going full steam, finally feeling that he's not going to have to worry about money anymore, and he can do what he wants, and his reputation is coming fine. His operas are selling out. And he has these new ideas and new material that he's going to be able to do, and he's going to take over the best job in town. And he's already found a new voice in sacred music, and then just wham, that's it. Sorry.
Yeah.
And that's why I say he died in mid-stride.
One more thing. Let me ask you this finally. You say in the end, much of what sets Mozart apart from Beethoven was how you describe the amity of his music, that this was the art of a sociable man intended for friends and small groups, that his music was, if Beethoven may have been concerned about legacy and immortality, Mozart was writing for buddies, for people that he loved, I guess.
Yes. I didn't come to that. The line that I used at the end of the book is something that I came on when I got to the end of the book. But what I realized that Beethoven was writing for an increasingly Beethoven's chamber music was still played in private, and a lot of his orchestra music too. But he was moving toward what was coming in the 19th century, which was public music performance. And Beethoven was writing for posterity. He was very aware of that. So in a way, he was writing for humanity. Mozart was writing for a milieu of private musical performance, including a lot of orchestra performance in those days. He knew public stuff, too. He'd experienced that. And his last symphonies are influenced by Haydn's symphonies, which were written for big public concerts in England. But Mozart was mostly writing for people he knew in small-scale settings where he was selling his music to publishers he knew personally. I read an article by a psychiatrist who had sort of studied the famous geniuses of Western culture, and he said of all of them, Mozart was the most sociable. He often composed in company with people around. He liked to play cards and pool and bowl and do all these physical things with people around. He had a house full of, servants and wife and students and birds and dogs. The house was an absolute ruckus all the time, except in the middle of the night, which is when he did a lot of his composing. But he wrote for what I ended up saying is Beethoven wrote for humanity. Mozart wrote for people. And his music has that kind of thing that I'm going to make you happy. I'm going to write music that will make people happy, make my friends happy. A classic case of that is that what's called the Kegelstadt Trio, which is an odd instrumentation for clarinet, viola, and piano. Well, he wrote it for a party. And it was the clarinet part was his friend Anton Stadler, who was maybe the greatest clarinetist in the world. The viola part was for himself. And the piano part was for this very fine teenage pianist. And I'm pretty sure the party was at her family's house. So he wrote a piece for his friends to be played for friends at a party and a sociable occasion. It's one of the great masterpieces of chamber music, one of the most warmly melodic and beautiful. And that, in a way, is Mozart in a nutshell, writing not for posterity, not to express his soul, but to use his soul and his understanding to write to make people happy and touched and moved in the kind of intimate situation that where music was mostly heard in those days.
Jan Swofford, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been great fun.
Jan Swofford. His new biography is Mozart, The Reign of Love. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Stu Nolan. The program is produced by Carrie Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.